grabbed it, ripped it open, and pulled out a 3-page letter. He then proceeded to read it slowly, oblivious to his lawyer. Sandy flipped through the file and settled on the nudie pictures of Trudy reclining by the pool with her gigolo sprawled nearby. He couldn't wait to show these to her lawyer in Mobile. They had a meeting scheduled in 3 hours. Patrick finished the letter, carefully refolded it, and placed it in the envelope. "I have another letter for her," he said. He glanced across the table and saw the photos. "Pretty good work, huh?" "It's amazing. I've never seen this much proof in a divorce case." "Well, there was a lot to work with. We'd been married almost 2 years when I bumped into her first husband, quite by accident. It was at a party before a Saints game in New Orleans. We had a few drinks, and he told me about Lance. He's the tomcat in the pictures there." Leah explained it. "Trudy was very pregnant at the time, so I said nothing. The marriage was slowly unraveling, and we hoped the child would make things perfect. She has an amazing capacity for deceit. I decided to play along, be a proud daddy and all that, but a year later I started gathering evidence. I wasn't sure when I would need it, but I knew the marriage was over. I left town every chance I got, business, hunting, fishing, weekends with the boys, whatever. She never seemed to mind. I meet with her lawyer at 5 p.m. "Good. You'll have a great time. It's a lawyer's dream. Threaten everything, but walk away with the settlement. She has to sign away all rights, Sandy. She gets none of my assets." "When do we talk about your assets?" "Soon, I promise. But there is something more pressing." Sandy removed his obligatory legal pad and poised himself to take notes. "I'm listening," he said. "Lance is a nasty character. He grew up in the bars along Point Cadet, never finished high school, and served 3 years for smuggling dope. A bad seed. He has friends in the underworld. He knows people who'll do anything for money. There's another thick file, this one on him. I take it Leah didn't give it to you." "No, just this one." "Ask her about it next time. I gathered dirt on Lance for a year with the same private detective. Lance is a small-time hood, but he's dangerous because he has friends. And Trudy has money. We don't know how much is left, but she probably hasn't spent it all."
"And you think he's coming after you?"
"Probably. Think about it, Sandy. Trudy is the only person right now who still needs me dead. If I'm out of the way, she keeps the money she has left, and she doesn't worry about the insurance company getting what she now owns. I know her. The money and the lifestyle mean everything."
"But how could he?"
"It can be done, Sandy. Believe me, it can be done." He said this with the calm assurance of one who had committed murder and gotten by with it, and for a second Sandy's blood ran cold. "It can easily be done," he said for the third time, his eyes glaring, the wrinkles around them pinched tightly.
"Okay, what am I supposed to do, sit with the deputies in the hallway?"
"You create the fiction, Sandy."
"I'm listening."
"First you tell her lawyer that your office has received an anonymous tip that Lance is in the market for a hitman. Do this at the end of your meeting today. By then the guy will be shell-shocked and he'll believe anything you say. Tell him you plan to meet with the cops and discuss this. He'll no doubt call his client, who'll deny it vehemently, but her credibility with him will be shot. Trudy will recoil at the very idea that someone else suspects she and Lance have entertained such thoughts. Then meet with the sheriff and the FBI and tell the same story. Tell them why you're worried about my safety. Insist that they chat with Trudy and Lance about these rumors. I know her very well, Sandy. She'll sacrifice Lance to keep the money, but not if there's the chance she'll get caught, too. If the cops are suspicious now, she'll back off."
"You've given this some thought. Anything else?"
"Yes. The last thing you do is leak it to the press. You need to find a reporter.
That shouldn't be hard to do.
One that you can trust."
"Much harder."
"Not really. I've been reading the papers, and I have a couple of names for you. Check them out. Find one you like. Tell him to print the rumors off the record, and in return you'll give him first shot at the real stories. That's the way these guys operate. Tell him the sheriff is investigating reports of the wife attempting to procure the services of a contract killer so she can keep the money. He'll eat it up. He won't have to validate the story. Hell, they print rumors all the time." Sandy finished his notes and marveled at his client's preparation. He closed his file, tapped it with his pen, and asked, "How much of this stuff do you have?"
"Dirt?" Yeah. I'd guess 50 pounds. It's been locked in a mini-storage in Mobile ever since I disappeared.
What else is there?
More dirt.
On who? My former partners. And others. We'll get to it later.
When?
Soon, Sandy.
Trudy's lawyer, J. Murray Riddleton, was a jovial, thick-necked man of 60 who specialized in two types of law, big, nasty divorces and financial advice aimed at cheating the government. He was a quick study in contrasts, successful but badly dressed, intelligent but plain-faced, smiling but vicious, mild-spoken but sharp-tongued. His large office in downtown Mobile was strewn with long-neglected files and out-of-date law books. He politely welcomed Sandy, indicated a chair, and offered a drink. It was, after all, a few minutes after 5. Sandy declined, and J. Murray drank nothing.
"So how's our boy?" J. Murray asked, flashing teeth.
"That would be..."
"Come on, our boy, Patrick. Have you found the money yet?"
"Didn't know I was looking for any." J. Murray found this hilarious and laughed a few seconds. There was no doubt in his mind that he was thoroughly in control of this meeting. The cards were heavily stacked on his side of the desk. "I saw your client on TV last night," Sandy said. "That sleazy tabloid, what's it called?"
"Inside Journal. Wasn't she marvelous? And the little girl, what a doll. Those poor people."
"My client would like to request that your client refrain from any further public comment about their marriage and divorce."
"Your client can kiss my client's ass, and you can kiss mine."
"I'll pass, as will my client."
"Look, son, I'm a First Amendment hawk. Say anything, do anything, publish anything. It's all protected right there by the Constitution."
He pointed to a wall of cobwebbed law books next to his window.
"Request denied. My client has the right to go public with anything she wants, any time she wants. She's been humiliated by your client and now faces a very uncertain future."
"Fair enough. Just wanted to clear the air."
"Is it clear enough?"
"Yes. Now, we really have no problems with your client's desire to get a divorce, and she can have custody of the child."
"Gee, thanks. You guys are being generous."
"In fact, my client has no plans to seek visitation rights with the child."
"Smart man. After abandoning the child for 4 years, he'd be hard-pressed to see her."
"There is another reason," Sandy said as he opened the file and picked out the DNA test. He handed a copy across to J. Murray, who had stopped smiling and was squinting at the papers.
"What's this?" he asked suspiciously.
"Why don't you read it?" Sandy said. J. Murray yanked his reading glasses from a coat pocket and stuck them to his rather round head. He pushed the report away, got it just right, then read it slowly. He glanced up with a blank look after page 1, and his buoyant shoulders sagged a bit at the end of page 2.
"Disastrous, isn't it?" Sandy said when J. Murray had finished. "Don't patronize me. I'm sure this can be explained."
"I'm sure it cannot. Under Alabama law, the DNA is conclusive proof. Now, I'm not quite the First Amendment hawk you are, but if this got published, it would be very embarrassing for your client. Imagine having someone else's child while pretending to be happily married to another. Wouldn't play well along the coast, I'm afraid."
"Publish it," J. Murray said with no conviction. "I don't care."
"Better check with your client first."
"It's insignificant under our law. Even if she committed adultery, he continued to live with her after he knew. Therefore, he accepted it. He's barred from using it as grounds for divorce."
"Forget the divorce. She can have that. Forget the kid, too."
"Oh, I see then. It's extortion. She releases her claim to his assets and he doesn't go public."
"Something like that."
"Your client's crazy as hell, and so are you."
J. Murray's cheeks turned red and his fists clenched for a second. Sandy coolly flipped through the file and extracted the next bit of damage. He slid a report across the desk.
"What is it?"
J. Murray demanded.
"Read it." "I'm tired of reading."
"Okay. It's a report by the private detective who followed your client and her boyfriend for a year prior to my client's disappearance. They were together, alone, at various places, but primarily at my client's home, indoors, and we presume in bed, on at least 16 occasions.
Big deal.
Check these out, Sandy said, and flung 2 8x10 color photos, 2 of the nude ones, on top of the report. J. Murray glanced, then grabbed them for a more in-depth study. Sandy decided to be helpful. Those were taken by the pool at my client's home while he was attending a seminar in Dallas. Recognize anyone? J. Murray managed a slight grunt. There are many more, Sandy promised, then waited for J. Murray to stop his gawking. And I also have 3 other reports from private detectives. Seems my client was quite suspicious. Before Sandy's eyes, J. Murray was transformed from a hard-nosed advocate to a soulful mediator, a chameleon-like conversion common among lawyers who suddenly found themselves stripped of ammunition. He exhaled, heavily, defeated, and sat low in his leather swivel.
"They never tell us everything, do they?" he said.
It was suddenly us versus them, lawyers versus their clients. He and Sandy were really together now, and what were they to do? Sandy, though, was not ready for the tag team. Again, I'm not the First Amendment hawk you claim to be, but if these found their way into the tabloids, then it sure would be embarrassing for Trudy. J. Murray waved him off and glanced at his watch.
Sure you don't want a drink?
I'm sure.
What's your boy got?
I honestly don't know yet. And that's not the important question. What matters is what he will have left when the dust settles, and right now no one knows.
Surely he's got most of the 90 million.
He's being sued for much more than that. Not to mention the possibility of a long prison sentence and maybe an execution. This divorce, Mr. Riddleton, is the least of his worries.
Then why are you threatening us?
He wants her to shut up. To get her divorce and go away, and to release all future claims against him. He wants it done now.
If not?
J. Murray loosened his tie and sunk an inch lower. The day was suddenly late. He needed to go home. He thought for a long minute, then said,
She'll lose everything. Does he know that? The life insurance company will wipe her out.
There are no winners here, Mr. Riddleton.
Let me speak to her.
Sandy gathered his things and made a slow retreat to the door. J. Murray managed another sad smile, and just as they were shaking hands to depart, Sandy, as if he had almost forgotten it, mentioned the anonymous tip his office had received in New Orleans about Lance searching for a hitman. He didn't know if he believed it, but he felt compelled to discuss it with the sheriff and the FBI anyway. They discussed it briefly. Riddleton promised to mention it to his client. Chapter 21 Dr. Hayani's last stop was Patrick's room. It was almost dark, long past time to leave for the day, and he found his famous patient sitting in his gym shorts in a chair at a makeshift desk in the only empty corner of his room. The desk was a small table with a lamp Patrick had conned out of an orderly. A plastic water cup held pens and pencils. Another held the beginning of a collection of paper clips, rubber bands, push pins, all donated by the nursing staff. He even had 3 legal pads. Patrick was in business. An impressive collection of legal documents occupied one corner, and he was reviewing one of the numerous lawsuits filed against him when his doc popped in for the 3rd time of the day. "Welcome to my office," Patrick said. A bulky TV hung not far above his head. The back of his chair was a foot from the end of his bed.
"Nice," Hayani said.
Rumors in hospitals flew faster than in law offices, and throughout the last 2 days there had been amused whispers about the new firm being established in room 312.
"I hope you don't sue doctors."
"Never. In 13 years of practicing law, I never sued a doctor, nor a hospital." He stood as he said this and turned to face Hayani.
"I knew I liked you," the doctor said as he gently examined the burns on Patrick's chest. "How are you doing?"
he asked for the 3rd time that day.
"I'm fine," Patrick repeated for the umpteenth time that day. The nurses, star-struck and curious, barged in at least 2 an hour with any one of 100 errands, and always with a chirping, "How you feeling?"
"I'm fine," he always answered.
"Did you nap today?"
Hayani asked, squatting and poking along the left thigh.
"No," It's hard to sleep without pills, and I really hate to take anything during the day, Patrick answered. In truth, napping was impossible with the parade of nurses and orderlies. He sat on the edge of the bed and looked sincerely at his doctor.
Can I tell you something? He asked.
Ayani stopped scribbling on a chart.
Certainly.
Patrick cast his eyes to the left and to the right, as if there could be ears everywhere.
When I was a lawyer, he began softly, I had this client, a banker, who got caught embezzling. He was 44 years old, married, 3 teenage kids, a great guy who did a dumb thing. He was arrested at home, late at night, and taken to the county jail. It was crowded, and he got thrown into a cell with a couple of young street punks, black guys, mean as hell. They gagged him first so he couldn't scream. They beat him. Then they did things you don't want to know about. 2 hours after he was sitting in his den watching a movie, he was half dead in a jail cell 3 miles from his home. Patrick's chin hit his chest, and he pinched the bridge of his nose. Dr. Hayani touched his shoulder. You can't let that happen to me, Doc, Patrick said, his eyes watery, his voice strained.
Don't worry, Patrick. The thought of it horrifies me, Doc. I have nightmares about it.
You have my word, Patrick. God knows I've been through enough. I promise, Patrick.
The next interrogator was a squirrely little man named Warren, who chain-smoked and viewed the world through thick, dark glasses. His eyes were invisible. His left hand worked the cigarette, his right one handled the pen, and nothing else moved except his lips. He crouched behind his neat little piles of paper and shot questions to the other end, where Stefano fiddled with a paper clip and his lawyer fought with a laptop.
"When did you form your consortium?" Warren asked.
"After we lost his trail in New York, we pulled back and waited. We listened where we could listen, we covered old tracks. Nothing happened. The trail quickly ran cold, and we settled in for the long run. I'd met with Benny Aricia, and he was willing to finance the search. Then I also met with people from Monarch Sierra and Northern Case Mutual, and they gave their tentative approval. Northern Case Mutual had just forked over $2.5 million to the widow. They couldn't sue to get it back because there was no conclusive evidence he was still alive. They agreed to put up $500,000. Monarch Sierra was more complicated because they had not paid at that time. Their exposure was $4 million.
Monarch carried the law firm's malpractice insurance?
Close. It was a separate crime rider, in addition to the customary errors and omissions policy. It protected the law firm from fraud and theft by its employees and partners. Since Lanigan stole from the firm, Monarch Sierra was forced to pay up to the tune of $4 million.
But your client, Mr. Aricia, received this money, correct?
Yes. He first sued the law firm for the entire $60 million he lost, but the firm had few assets. The firm agreed to hand over the proceeds from the policy. We all sat down at the table and struck a deal. Monarch Sierra agreed to pay the money without a fight if Mr. Aricia would use up to $1 million of it to find Lanigan. Mr. Aricia agreed, but only if Monarch Sierra would kick in another $1 million to finance the search.
So Aricia was in for $1 million, Monarch Sierra for $1 million, and Northern Case Mutual for $500,000, total of $2.5 million.
Yes, that was the initial agreement.
Where was the law firm?
They chose not to participate. Frankly, they didn't have the money, and they were too shocked to respond. Initially, they helped in other ways.
And the players paid up?
Yes, the money was wired to my firm's account.
Now that the search is over, how much of the money is left?
Almost none.
How much was spent?
$3.5 million, give or take a little. About a year ago, the funds ran out. The insurance company said no. Mr. Aricia kicked in another $500,000, then another $300,000. His total to date is $1.9 million.
Actually, it was an even $2 million now that Benny had reluctantly decided to go after the girl. The FBI, of course, would not know this.
And how was the money spent?
Stefano referred to his notes, but only for a glimpse.
Almost $1 million in payroll, travel, and other expenses related to the search, $1.5 million in rewards, and an even $1 million to my firm as fees.
You've been paid $1 million?
Warren asked, still with no movement of muscle, but with a slightly raised voice.
Yes, over a 4-year period.
Tell me about the rewards.
Well, it goes to the heart of the search.
We're listening.
One of the first things we did was to establish a reward for any information about the disappearance of Patrick Lanigan. You guys knew about the reward, but you thought the law firm was backing it. We quietly went to the law firm and convinced Charles Bogan to announce the formation of a reward for information. He went public and promised $50,000 at first. Our deal with Bogan was that he would secretly notify us if there was any response.
The FBI was not informed of this.
No. The FBI knew about the reward and approved it, but our agreement with Bogan was kept quiet. We wanted the first shot at any information. We didn't distrust the FBI. We simply wanted to find Lanigan and the money ourselves.
How many men did you have working on the case at this point?
Probably a dozen.
And where were you?
Here. But I went to Biloxi at least once a week.
Did the FBI know what you were doing?
Absolutely not. To my knowledge, the FBI never knew we were involved until last week.
The file in front of Warren certainly reflected this. Continue.
We heard nothing for 2 months, 3 months, four. We raised the reward money to 75, then to 100. Bogan got hammered with all the nuts out there, and he passed this along to the FBI. Then, in August of 92, he got a call from a lawyer in New Orleans who claimed to have a client who knew something about the disappearance. The guy sounded very legitimate, and so we went to New Orleans to meet with him.
What was his name?
Raoul Lozier on Loyola Street.
Did you meet with him?
I did.
And who else from your firm?
Stefano glanced at his lawyer, who had frozen for the moment and was deep in thought.
This is a secretive business. I'd rather not mention the names of my associates.
He doesn't have to, the lawyer pronounced loudly, and that was the end of the matter. Fine. Continue.
Lozier appeared to be serious, ethical, and believable. He was also very prepared. He seemed to know everything about the disappearance of Patrick and the money. He had a file of all the press clippings, everything was indexed and at his fingertips. He handed us a 4-page, double-spaced narrative of what his client knew.
Just summarize it in detail. I'll read it later.
Certainly, Stefano said, and recounted the narrative from memory. His client was a young woman named Erin, who was struggling through med school at Tulane. She was recently divorced, broke, etc., and to help make ends meet, she worked a late shift in a large bookstore in a mall, one of those big chains. Sometime in January of 92, she noticed a customer milling around the travel and language section. He was heavy set, dressed in a suit, neat black and gray beard, and appeared to be somewhat nervous. It was almost 9 at night, and the store was practically deserted. We finally picked out a language course with 12 cassettes, workbooks, etc., all in one slick box, and he was easing toward the checkout area where Erin worked when another man entered the store. The first man immediately withdrew between the racks and placed the language course back on the shelf. He then emerged on the other side and attempted to slip past the second man, a person he obviously knew and didn't want to speak to. But he didn't make it. The second man glanced up and said, "Patrick, it's been a long time." A brief conversation ensued in which the two men talked about their law careers. Erin putted around the checkout stand and listened because there was nothing else to do. Evidently, she was keenly curious and watched everything. Anyway, the one called Patrick was anxious to leave, so he finally found a right moment and made a graceful getaway. 3 nights later, at about the same time, he came back. Erin was putting up stock, not checking out. She saw him enter, recognized him, remembered he was called Patrick, and watched him. He made a point to look at the checkout clerk, and when he realized she was a different one, he loitered around the store until he stopped in the language and travel section. He picked out the same language course, slid to the counter, paid for it in cash, and left quickly, almost $300. Erin watched him leave. He never saw her, or if he did, he didn't recognize her.
So what's the language?
That, of course, was the big question.
3 weeks later, Erin saw in the paper where Patrick Lanigan was killed in a terrible auto accident, and she recognized his picture. Then, 6 weeks later, the story broke about the stolen money from his old firm. The same picture was in the papers, and Erin saw it again.
Did the bookstore have security cameras?
No, we checked.
So what was the language?
Lozier wouldn't tell us. At least at first he wouldn't. We were offering $100,000 for solid information about Lanigan's whereabouts. He and his client quite naturally wanted all of the money for the name of the language. We negotiated for 3 days. He wouldn't budge. He allowed us to interrogate Erin. We spent 6 hours with her, and every aspect of her story checked out, so we agreed to pay it $100,000.
Brazilian Portuguese?
Yes. The world suddenly shrunk.
Like every lawyer, J. Murray Riddleton had been through it many times before, unfortunately. The airtight case suddenly springs leaks. The tables get turned in the blink of an eye. Just for the fun of it, and with no small measure of enjoyment, he allowed Trudy to puff and posture for a bit before he lowered the axe.
"Adultery!"
she gasped, with all the self-righteousness of a Puritan virgin. Even Lance pulled off a look of shock. He reached across and took her hand.
I know, J. Murray said, playing along. Happens in almost every divorce. These things do get nasty.
I'll kill him, Lance grunted.
We'll get to that later, J. Murray said.
With whom?
She demanded.
With Lance here. They claim the two of you were getting it on before, during, and after the marriage. In fact, they claim it goes all the way back to high school.
9th grade, actually.
He's an idiot, Lance said, without conviction.
Trudy nodded and agreed with Lance, preposterous. Then she asked nervously,
What proof does he claim to have?
Do you deny it?
J. Murray asked, completing the setup.
Absolutely,
she snapped.
Of course, added Lance. The man is a living lie.
J. Murray reached into a deep drawer and withdrew one of the reports Sandy had given him.
Seems Patrick was suspicious throughout most of the marriage. He hired investigators to snoop around. This is a report from one of them.
Trudy and Lance looked at each other for a second, then realized they had been caught. Suddenly it was difficult to deny a relationship that was now more than 20 years old. They both became smug at the same instant. So what? Big deal.
I'll just summarize it,
J. Murray said, then clicked off dates, times, and places. They weren't ashamed of their activities, but it was discomforting to know that things were so well documented.
Still deny it?
J. Murray asked when he finished.
Anybody can write that stuff, Lance said.
Trudy was silent. J. Murray pulled out another report, this one covering the 7 months prior to Patrick's disappearance. Dates, times, places. Patrick left town, bam, Lance moved in, every time.
Can these investigators testify in court?
Lance asked when J. Murray finished.
We're not going to court, J. Murray said.
Why not?
Trudy asked.
Because of these.
J. Murray slid the 8x10 color glossies across his desk. Trudy grabbed one and gasped at the sight of herself lounging by the pool, naked, her stud next to her. Lance was shocked, too, but managed a tiny grin. He sort of liked them. They swapped the photos back and forth without a word. J. Murray relished the moment, then said,
You guys got too careless. Skip the lecture,
Lance said. Predictably, Trudy started to cry. Her eyes watered, her lip quivered, her nose sniffled, and then she cried. J. Murray had seen it 1,000 times. They always cried, not for what they had done, but for the wages of their sins.
"He's not getting my daughter,"
she said angrily through the tears. She lost it, and they listened to her bawl for a while. Lance, ever vigilant, pawed at her and tried to console.
"I'm sorry,"
she finally said, wiping tears.
Relax, J. Murray said, without the slightest trace of compassion. He doesn't want the kid.
Why not?
She asked, the tear duct shutting down instantly.
He's not the father.
They squinted, thought hard, tried to assemble things. J. Murray reached for yet another report.
He took a blood sample from the child when she was 14 months old and had a DNA test run on it. No way he's the father.
Then who? Lance started to ask, but couldn't complete the thought.
Depends on who else was around, J. Murray said helpfully.
No one else was around,
she said, mocking him angrily.
Except me,
Lance volunteered, then slowly closed his eyes. Fatherhood descended heavily upon his shoulders. Lance despised children. He tolerated Ashley Nicole only because she belonged to Trudy.
"Congratulations,"
J. Murray said. He reached into a drawer, pulled out a cheap cigar, and tossed it to Lance.
"It's a girl,"
he said, and laughed loudly. Trudy fumed, and Lance toyed with the cigar. When J. Murray finished humoring himself, she asked,
"So where are we?" "It's simple. You waive any right to his assets, whatever they may be, and he gives you the divorce, the kid, everything else you want."
"What are his assets?" she asked.
"His lawyer is not sure right now. We may never know. The man is headed for death row, and the cash might stay buried forever."
"But I'm about to lose everything," she said. "Look at what he's done to me. I got $2.5 million when he died. Now the insurance company is ready to bankrupt me."
"She deserves a hell of a lot of money," Lance piped in on cue.
"Can I sue him for mental distress or fraud or something like that?" she pleaded.
"No. Look, it's very simple. You get the divorce and the kid, and Patrick keeps whatever money is out there. And everything is kept quiet. Otherwise he'll leak all this to the press."
J. Murray tapped the reports and the photos when he said this.
"And you'll be humiliated. You've gone public with your dirty laundry. He's quite anxious to return the favor."
"Where do I sign?" she said.
J. Murray fixed them all a vodka, and before too long he was mixing another round. He finally brought up the subject of those silly rumors about Lance looking for a hitman. The denials came fast and furious, and J. Murray confessed that he really didn't believe the trash anyway. There were so many rumors racing up and down the coast. Chapter 22 They began tracking Sandy McDermott as he left New Orleans at 8 a.m. and worked his way through the traffic on Interstate 10. He was followed until the congestion thinned near Lake Pontchartrain. They called ahead and reported he was on his way to Biloxi. Following him was easy. Listening would be another matter. Guy had bugs for Sandy's office and home phones, even one for his car, but the decision to install them had not yet been made. The risks were significant. Aricia especially was wary. He argued with Stefano and with Guy that Sandy might well expect his phones to get tapped, and might feed them all sorts of useless or even damaging gossip. His client had so far proved quite proficient at seeing around corners. And so they argued. Sandy wasn't looking over his shoulder, nor was he seeing much in front of him. He was simply driving, moving forward while avoiding contact, his mind, as usual, many miles away. From a strategic point of view, the various Lanigan battles were in good shape. The civil suits filed by Monarch Sierra, the law firm, and Aricia had been placed on dockets already densely crowded. Formal responses by Sandy were a month away. Discovery wouldn't start for 3 months and would last for a year. Trials were 2 years away at the earliest. Likewise for Patrick's suit against the FBI. It would one day be amended to bring in Stefano and his consortium. It would be a delightful case to try, but Sandy doubted he would ever get the chance. The divorce was under control. The capital murder charge, clearly the center of attention, was another matter. Obviously the most serious of Patrick's problems, it was also the speediest. By law, the state had to try Patrick within 270 days of the indictment, so the clock was ticking. In Sandy's opinion, a conviction based on the evidence would be a long shot. For the moment, crucial elements of proof were missing. Significant facts, such as the identity of John Doe and the manner in which he died, and the certainty that Patrick killed him. It was a tenuous circumstantial case at best. Large assumptions would be called for. However, a conviction based on public sentiment was foreseeable. By now, everyone within 100 miles of Biloxi knew most of the details, and you couldn't find a literate, breathing soul who didn't think Patrick killed someone to fake his death so he could lie in ambush and steal $90 million. Patrick had a few admirers, those who also dreamed of a new life with a new name and plenty of dough, but they would not be on his jury. Most folks, it seemed, through the informal polling of coffee shop talk and courthouse gossip, felt he was guilty and should spend time in prison. Very few favored the death penalty. Leave that for rapists and cop killers. Most pressing, though, at the moment was keeping Patrick alive. The file on Lance, hand-delivered last night by the lovely Leia in yet another hotel room, portrayed a quiet man with a hair-triggered temper and a penchant for violence. He liked guns and had once been indicted by a federal grand jury for fencing them through a pawn shop. The charges were later dismissed. In addition to his 3-year stint for smuggling pot, he had been sentenced to 60 days for his part in a barroom brawl in Gulfport, though the time was suspended due to an overcrowded jail. There were 2 other arrests, one for another fight and one for a DUI. Lance could be cleaned up and made presentable. He was lanky and handsome and well-admired by the ladies. He knew how to dress and carry on amusing chit-chat over cocktails. But his forays into society were temporary. His heart was always in the street, just above the gutter, where he hung out with loan sharks and bookies and fences and reputable drug dealers, the smart white-collar boys of local crime. These were his friends, the guys from his neighborhood. Patrick had found them, too. And the file contained no fewer than 12 little biographies of Lance's pals, all with criminal records. Sandy at first had been skeptical of Patrick's paranoia. Now he believed it. Though he knew little of the underworld, the nature of his profession occasionally brought him into contact with criminals. He had heard many times that for $5,000 you could get anyone killed, maybe even less along the coast. Lance certainly had more than $5,000, and he had a wonderful motive to eliminate Patrick. The life insurance policies that made Trudy rich didn't exclude any particular causes of death other than suicide. A bullet to the head was treated just like a car wreck, or a heart attack, or anything else. Dead was dead. The coast was not Sandy's turf. He didn't know the sheriffs and their deputies, the judges and their quirks, the other members of the bar. He suspected this was precisely why Patrick picked him. Sweeney had been less than hospitable on the phone. He was very busy, he said, and besides, meetings with lawyers were usually a waste of time. He could spare a few minutes starting at 9:30 and barring an emergency. Sandy arrived early and poured his own coffee from a pot he found next to the water cooler. Deputies milled about. The sprawling jail was in the rear. Sweeney found him and led him through to his office, a Spartan room with government hand-me-down furniture and fading photos of smiling politicians on the wall. "Have a seat," Sweeney said, pointing to a ratty chair as he sat behind his desk. Sandy did as he was told. "Mind if I record?" Sweeney asked, already punching the button on a large tape recorder in the center of his desk. "I tape everything," he said. "Sure," Sandy said, as if he had a choice. "Thanks for working me in." "No problem," Sweeney said. He had yet to smile or offer anything other than the impression of being bothered by this. He lit a cigarette and sipped steaming coffee from a styrofoam cup. "I'll get right to the point," Sandy said, as if idle conversation were not an option. "My office has received a tip that Patrick's life may be in danger." Sandy hated the lying, but he had little choice under the circumstances. This was what his client wanted.
"Why would someone tip your office that your client was in danger?" Sweeney asked.
"I have investigators working on the case. They know lots of people. Some gossip got passed along, and one of my investigators tracked it down. That's the way these things happen." Sweeney showed neither belief nor disbelief. He smoked his cigarette and thought about it. In the past week, he had heard every conceivable species of rumor about the adventures of Patrick Lanigan. People were talking about nothing else. The hitman's stories were of several varieties. Sweeney figured his network was better than the lawyer's, especially one from New Orleans, so he would let him talk.
"Got any suspects?"
"Yes. His name is Lance Maxa. I'm sure you know him."
"We do."
"He took Patrick's place with Trudy not long after the funeral."
"Some would say Patrick took his place," Sweeney said with his first smile.
Sandy was indeed on foreign turf. The sheriff knew more than he. "Then I guess you know all about Lance and Trudy," Sandy said, a little rattled.
"We do," We take good notes around here.
I'm sure you do.
Anyway, Lance, as you know, is a nasty sort, and my men got a rumor that he was looking for a contract killer.
How much is he offering? Sweeney asked skeptically.
Don't know. But he has the money, and he has the motive.
I've already heard this.
Good. What do you plan to do?
About what?
About keeping my client alive.
Sweeney took a deep breath and decided to hold his tongue. He struggled with his temper.
He's on a military base in a hospital room with my deputies guarding his door and FBI agents down the hall. I'm not sure what else you have in mind.
Look, Sheriff, I'm not trying to tell you how to do your job.
Really?
No, I promise. Please try and understand that my client is a very frightened man right now. I'm here acting on his behalf. He's been stalked for over 4 years. He's been caught. He hears voices we don't hear. He sees shadows we don't see. He's convinced people will try to kill him, and he expects me to protect him.
He's safe.
For now. What if you talked to Lance, and you grilled him pretty good and told him about the rumors? If he knew you were watching, he'd be stupid to try something.
Lance is stupid.
Maybe, but Trudy is not. If she thinks she might get caught, she'll yank Lance back where he belongs.
Been yanking him all his life.
Precisely. She will not run the risk.
Sweeney lit another cigarette and glanced at his watch.
Anything else? He asked, suddenly anxious to get up and leave. He was a sheriff, not an office manager with a desk and Rolodex.
Just one thing. And again, I'm not trying to tend to your business. Patrick has enormous respect for you.
But, well, he thinks he's much safer where he is.
What a surprise.
Jail could be dangerous for him.
He should have thought about that before he killed Mr. Doe.
Sandy ignored this and said he'll be easier to protect in the hospital.
Have you been to my jail?
No.
Then don't lecture me about how unsafe it is. I've been doing this for a long time, got it?
I'm not lecturing.
The hell you're not. You got 5 more minutes. Anything else?
No.
Good.
Sweeney bolted to his feet and left the room. The Honorable Carl Husky arrived at Keesler Air Force Base late in the afternoon and slowly made his way through security to the hospital. He was in the middle of a 1-week drug trial, and he was tired. Patrick had called and asked him to stop by if possible. Himself a pallbearer, Carl had sat next to Sandy McDermott at Patrick's funeral. Unlike Sandy, though, Husky had been a recent friend of Patrick's. The two had met during a civil case Patrick had tried not long after he arrived in Biloxi. They became friendly, the way lawyers and judges often do when they see each other every week. They chatted over bad food at the monthly bar luncheons, and once drank too much at a Christmas party. They played golf twice a year. It was an easy acquaintance, but not a close friendship, at least not for the first 3 years Patrick was in Biloxi. But they grew closer in the months before he disappeared. With the benefit of hindsight, though, it was easy to look back and see a change in Patrick. In the months after his disappearance, those in the legal community who knew him best, including Carl, liked to gather over drinks at the lower bar at Mary Mahoney's restaurant on Friday afternoons and piece together the Patrick puzzle. Trudy took her share of the blame, though she was too easy a target, in Carl's opinion. On the surface, the marriage didn't appear to be that bad. Patrick certainly didn't discuss it with anybody, at least no one who drank with them at Mary Mahoney's. Trudy's actions after the funeral, especially the red rolls and the live-in toy boy and the go-to-hell attitude she adopted as soon as the life insurance was collected, had soured everyone and made objectivity impossible. No one was certain that she was sleeping around before Patrick left. In fact, Buster Gillespie, the chancery clerk and a regular at those sessions, professed admiration for Trudy. She'd once worked with his wife at a charity ball of some variety, and he always felt compelled to say something nice about her. It was about the only one. Trudy was easy to talk about and easy to criticize. Job pressure was certainly a factor in pushing Patrick to the brink. The firm was rolling in those days, and he desperately wanted to become a partner. He worked long hours, and he took the difficult cases his partners didn't want. Not even the birth of Ashley Nicole kept him home. He had made partner 3 years after joining as an associate, but few people outside the firm knew it.
He had whispered it to Carl one day after court, but Patrick was not the least bit boastful. He was tired and stressed, but then so were most of the lawyers who entered Carl's courtroom. The oddest changes in Patrick were physical. He was an even 6 feet tall, and he said he had never been thin. He claimed to have been quite a jogger in law school, at one point doing 40 miles a week, but as a busy lawyer, who had the time? His weight crept up, then ballooned, the last year he was in Biloxi. He seemed oblivious to the jokes and comments from the courthouse crowd. Carl had chided him more than once, but he kept eating. A month before he disappeared, he told Carl over lunch that he weighed 230 pounds, and that Trudy was raising hell about it. She, of course, aerobicized 2 hours a day with Jane Fonda and was as thin as a model. He said his blood pressure was up, and he promised to go on a diet. Carl had encouraged this. He found out later that Patrick's blood pressure had been normal. The weight gain and its overnight loss made perfect sense now that they thought about it. The beard, too. He had grown it around November of 1990, said it was his deer-hunting beard. Such growth was not unusual among non-rednecks and lawyers in Mississippi. The air was cool. The testosterone was up. It was a boy thing. He didn't shave it, and Trudy bitched about that, too. The longer he kept it, the grayer it became. His friends got accustomed to it. She did not. He let his hair grow a bit and started wearing it thicker on top and halfway down the ears. Carl called it the Jimmy Carter look from 1976. Patrick claimed to have lost his hairstylist and couldn't find one he trusted. He wore nice clothes and carried his weight well, but he was too young to let himself go. 3 months before he checked out of Biloxi, Patrick succeeded in convincing his partners that the firm needed its own brochure. It was a small project, but one he embraced with great vigor. Though Patrick wasn't supposed to know it, the firm was getting closer to the Aresia settlement, and the money was almost in sight. Egos were expanding daily. A very serious firm was about to become a very wealthy one, so why not impress themselves with a professionally done brochure? It was a way to humor Patrick. Each of the five sat for a professional photographer, then they spent an hour on the group shot. Patrick printed 5,000 and received high marks from the other partners. There he was on page 2, fat, bearded, bushy-headed, and looking nothing like the Patrick they found in Brazil. The photo was used by the press when his death was reported. It was by far the most recent, and coincidentally, Patrick had sent a brochure to the local paper, just in case the firm decided to advertise. They had laughed about this over drinks at Mary Mahoney's. They could envision Patrick orchestrating the photography in the firm's conference room. They could see Bogan and Vetrano and Rapley and Haverack in the darkest navy suits and their most serious smiles, and all the while Patrick was laying the groundwork for his exit. In the months after he left them, the gang at Mary Mahoney's had toasted Patrick many times and played the game of where could he be. They had wished him well and thought about his money. Time passed, and so did the shock of his disappearance. Once they had thoroughly analyzed his life, the sessions came further apart and finally stopped. Months became years. Patrick would never be found. Carl still found it difficult to believe. He entered the elevator in the lobby and rode alone to the third floor. He wondered if he had ever given up on Patrick. The mysteries were too rich to escape. A bad day on the bench and he would think of Patrick on a sun-drenched beach, reading a novel, sipping a drink, watching the girls. Another year without a pay raise and he would wonder what the $90 million was doing. The latest rumor on the demise of the Bogan firm, and he would shame Patrick for the misery he had caused. No, the truth was Carl had thought of Patrick for one reason or another at least once a day, every day, since he left. There were no nurses or other patients in the hall. The two deputies stood. One said, "Evening, Judge." He greeted them and entered the darkened room. Chapter 23. Patrick was sitting in bed watching Jeopardy with his shirt off and the blinds drawn. A dim table light was on. "Sit here," he told Carl, pointing to the end of his bed. He waited just long enough for Carl to see the burns on his chest, then quickly slipped on a T-shirt. The sheet was up to his waist.
"Thanks for coming," he said. He turned the TV off, and the room grew even darker.
"Pretty nasty burns, Patrick," Carl said as he sat on the edge of the bed, as far away as possible, his right foot hanging off the edge.
Patrick pulled his knees to his chest. Under the sheet he still looked painfully thin.
"It was ugly," he said, his hands wrapped tightly around his knees. "Doc says they're healing okay, but I'll need to stay here for a while."
"I have no problem with that, Patrick. No one is screaming for you to be moved to the jail."
"Not yet, but I bet the press will start soon."
"Relax, Patrick. That decision will be made by me."
He seemed relieved.
"Thanks, Carl. You know I can't survive in jail. You've seen it."
"What about parchment? It's 100 times worse.
There was a long pause as Carl wished he could take back the words. It was instantaneous and cruel.
"I'm sorry," he said. "That was uncalled for."
"I'll kill myself before I go to parchment."
"I don't blame you. Let's talk about something pleasant."
"You can't keep this case, can you, Carl?"
"No, of course not. I'll have to recuse myself."
"When?"
"Pretty soon."
"Who'll get it?"
"Either Trussell or Lanks, probably Trussell."
Carl stared at him intently as he spoke. Patrick was having trouble with eye contact. Carl was waiting for a telling flicker from the eyes, followed by a grin, then a laugh as Patrick broke down and bragged about his escapades.
"Come on, Patrick," Carl wanted to say. "Let's hear it. Tell me the whole story."
But the eyes were distant. This was not the same Patrick. Carl felt compelled to try.
"Where'd you get that chin?"
"Bought it in Rio."
"And the nose?"
"Same place, same time. You like it?"
"That's handsome."
"In Rio they have drive-through plastic surgery shops."
"I hear they have beaches."
"Unbelievable beaches."
"Did you meet any girls down there?"
"A couple."
Sex was not a subject Patrick had ever dwelt on. He enjoyed a long, admiring gaze at an attractive woman, but to Carl's knowledge he had remained faithful to Trudy throughout their marriage. Once, at deer camp, they had compared notes about their wives. Patrick had admitted it was a challenge to keep Trudy satisfied. A long pause, and Carl realized Patrick was in no hurry to talk. The first minute passed in silence, and the second one dragged on. Carl was happy to visit, even delighted to see his friend, but there was a limit to how long he could sit in a dark room and stare at the walls.
"Look, Patrick, I will not hear your case, so I'm not here as your judge. I'm not your lawyer. I'm your friend. You can talk to me."
Patrick reached for a small can of orange juice with a straw in it. "Would you like something to drink?"
"No."
He took a short drink and put the can back on the table.
"I guess it sounds romantic, doesn't it?
The dream of simply walking away, vanishing into the night, and when the sun comes up, you're somebody new. All your problems are left behind, the drudgery of work, the heartbreak of a bad marriage, the pressure of becoming more and more affluent. You have that dream, don't you, Carl?"
"I guess everybody does at some point. How long did you plan it?"
"A long time. I seriously doubted that the baby was mine. I decided..."
"I beg your pardon?"
"It's true, Carl. I'm not the father. Trudy slept around throughout our marriage. I loved the child as best I could, but I was miserable. I gathered evidence and promised myself I would confront Trudy, but it was easy to put off. Oddly enough, I sort of got used to the idea that she had a lover. I was planning to leave, but I just didn't know how to do it. So I read a couple of underground books on how to change identities and obtain new papers. It's not complicated, it just takes a little thought and planning."
"So you grew a beard and gained 50 pounds.
"Yeah. I was amazed at how different I looked with a beard. That was right about the time I made partner, and I was already burned out. I was married to a woman who wasn't faithful, playing with a child who wasn't mine, working with a bunch of people I couldn't stand. Something clicked, Carl. I was driving one day along Highway 90, headed somewhere important but stuck in traffic, and I looked out across the Gulf. There was a lonely little sailboat, barely moving on the horizon. And I wanted so desperately to be on it,
to sail away to some place where no one knew me. I sat there, watching it move, aching so badly to swim out to it. I cried, Carl. Can you believe that? We all have days like that. Then I snapped, and I was never the same afterward. I knew I would vanish. How long did it take? I had to be patient. Most people get in a hurry when they decide to disappear, and they make mistakes. I had time. I wasn't broke or running from creditors. I bought a $2 million life insurance policy, and that took 3 months. I knew I couldn't leave Trudy and the baby with nothing. I started gaining the weight, eating like a maniac. I changed my will. I convinced Trudy that we should make our funeral and burial arrangements, and I did it without arousing suspicions. Cremation was a nice touch. Thanks. I highly recommend it. Makes it impossible to determine cause of death and identity, a few important things like that. Let's not talk about that. Sorry. Then I got wind of Mr. Benny Aricia and his little war with the Pentagon and Platt and Rockland Industries. Bogan kept him under wraps. I dug deeper and found out that Vetrano and Rapley and Haverack were all in on the deal, all the partners but me. They changed, Carl, all of them. They became secretive and devious. Sure, I was the new guy, but I was a partner, after all. They had voted unanimously to make me a full partner, and 2 months later they were dodging me while they conspired with Aricia. Suddenly I was the guy doing all the traveling, which worked out just beautifully for everyone. Trudy could arrange her little trysts, the partners could meet with Aricia without hiding. They sent me everywhere, which was fine with me, too, because I was making plans. Once I went to Fort Lauderdale for 3 days of depositions, and while I was there I found a guy in Miami who could do perfect papers. $2,000 and I had a new driver's license, passport, social security card, and voter registration papers from right here in Harrison County. Carl Hildebrand was my name, in honor of you. I'm touched. In Boston, I tracked down a guy who can get you lost. For $1,000, I had my own one-day seminar on how to vanish. In Dayton, I hired a surveillance expert who taught me about bugs and mics and dirty little devices like that. I was patient, Carl, very patient. I stayed at the office at odd hours and gathered as much of the Aricia story as I could get. I listened hard, quizzed secretaries, rummaged through the garbage. Then I began wiring offices, just a couple at first, to learn how it's done. I wired Vetrano's, and I couldn't believe what I heard. They were going to kick me out of the firm, Carl. Can you believe it? They knew their cut from the Aricia settlement would be around $30 million, and they were planning to split it 4 ways. But the pieces would not be equal. Bogan, of course, would get more, something close to $10 million. He had to take care of some people in Washington. The other 3 would get $5 million, and the rest would be spent on the firm. I, as it was planned, would be on the streets. When was this? Throughout most of 91. Aricia's claim got tentative justice approval to settle on December 14, 1991, and at that time it was taking about 90 days to get the money. Not even the senator could speed things along. Tell me about the car wreck. Patrick shifted his weight, then kicked his legs from under the sheet and got out of bed. A cramp, he mumbled as he stretched his back and legs. He stood by the bathroom door, rocking gently from one foot to the other, looking down at Carl. It was a Sunday. February 9th. Right, February 9th. I spent the weekend at my cabin, and as I was driving home, I had a wreck, got killed, and went to heaven. Carl watched him closely and never smiled. Try it again, he said. Why, Carl? Morbid fascination. Is that all? I promise. It was such a masterful job of deceit, Patrick. How'd you do it?
I may have to skip a few of the details.
I'm sure you will.
Let's take a walk. I'm tired of this place.
They entered the hall, and Patrick explained to his guards that he and the judge needed a stroll. The deputies followed at a distance. A nurse smiled and asked if she could bring anything. 2 Diet Cokes, Patrick said politely. Patrick walked very deliberately, saying nothing until they came to the end of the hallway, where plate-glass windows overlooked the parking lot. They sat on a vinyl bench, looking back down the hall, where the deputies waited 50 feet away, with their backs turned to them. Patrick wore scrub pants, no socks, leather sandals.
Have
Have you seen pictures of the crash site? He asked very quietly.
Yes.
I found it the day before. The ravine is fairly steep, and I thought it was the perfect place to have the accident. I waited until about 10 Sunday night and left the cabin. I stopped at a little store at the county line.
Verhall's.
Right, Verhall's. I filled the tank.
12 gallons, $14.21, paid with a credit card.
That sounds right. I chatted with Mrs. Verhall, then left. There wasn't much traffic. 2 miles away, I turned onto a gravel road and went a mile to a spot I had picked out. I stopped, opened the trunk, and proceeded to get dressed. I had a set of gear used by dirt bikers, a helmet, shoulder pads, knee and hand pads, the works. I quickly put it on, over my clothing, everything but the helmet, then returned to the highway where I drove south. The first time, there was a car behind me. The second time, there was a car coming toward me in the distance. I braked hard anyway, leaving skid marks. There was no traffic the third time. I put the helmet on, took a deep breath, and left the road. It was scary as hell, Carl. Carl figured that at this point there was another body somewhere in the car, either dead or alive, but he wouldn't ask. At least not now. I was only doing about 30 when I left the road, but 30 feels like 90 when you're airborne and trees are flying by. I was bouncing, snapping small trees, the windshield cracked. I was steering right and left, dodging as best I could, but a big pine tree caught the left front. The airbag exploded, and for a second I was knocked out. There was a tumbling sensation, and all was still. I opened my eyes and felt a sharp pain in my left shoulder. No blood. I was dangling somehow, and I realized that the blazer had come to rest on its right side. I began crawling out. By the time I got out of the damn thing, I knew I was lucky. My shoulder wasn't broken, just jammed. I walked around the blazer and was amazed at how well I had wrecked it. The roof had caved in just above my head. Another 6 inches, and I'm not sure I could have gotten out.
That seems incredibly risky. You could have been killed or badly injured. Why not simply push the car down the ravine?
Wouldn't work. It had to look real, Carl. The ravine was not steep enough. This is flat country, remember.
Why not put a brick on the accelerator and jump out of the way?
Bricks don't burn. If they found a brick in the car, maybe they would have been suspicious. I thought of everything, and I decided I could drive it into the trees and walk away.